Hello and welcome. Today on Food Talk Radio, we're doing an episode on the theme of food autonomy. And the reason we came to this newfangled term that I think we might have made up is that food sovereignty meant a little bit too strongly a supreme power or authority over your food. It implies a sense of jurisdiction, dominion, domination, authority, and a governmental power outside of the hand of the individual. In this episode on food autonomy, we want to take a look at how much control do we have individually over our food, and then relate that back to how much control our food has over us in our daily lives. Coming out of the month of January, there's a lot in the press, people struggling to take control of their diets, to lose weight, or to get healthier. And there's this presumption that the control is there for taking on behalf of the people. I for one, know that I've felt many times out of control of what I'm eating because, gosh, when you open that can of Pringles, once you pop, the fun just don't stop. And they've designed it that way on purpose. The same goes for a lot of other salty and sugary snacks that I've got to admit I just can't avoid sometimes. So hear us out. Give it a thought. How much do you control your food? How much does your food control you? In what ways do you control your food? And in what ways does your food control you?
In what ways I control my food. So with breakfast and lunch every day, I'll have the same thing, or like a slight variation on it. So I'll have a bowl of cereal, usually like a granola or a Special K, and half a grapefruit. And then with lunch, I'll have a blueberry smoothie, and then either like a salad or a soup, and then dinner is more variant, dinner is more fun.
Okay.
And in what way does food control me? I mean, like everyone else, I succumb to urges, right?
Of course.
To those cravings, late night especially, chocolate, so I try not to keep it in my place.
Okay.
That
Thanks
was
so
helpful.
Much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, don't you control your food when you manipulate some type of recipe or formulate some type of recipe? So if I have, like, carrots, celery, potato, and beef, I control that into a beef stew. I don't know if that's what you're going for, but...
Yeah.
Like, by way of recipes. Yeah, maybe I'm sucked into those golden arches. and then, well, maybe that's how food controls me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I'm driving down the street, I don't have time to make that beef stew, but I'm in White River Junction and I see the Golden Arches and I'm just sucked in, like some like magnetic force pulls me.
Like a moth to a flame.
Exactly. Exactly.
With our topic this month being food autonomy, we've been asking the question, do we control our food or does our food control us? This made me think of American philosophers that put self-reliance on a pedestal, notably Ralph Waldo Emerson, who favored the self-taught farm lad of the urban youth scared of failure. It also made me think of Thomas Jefferson and his agrarian ideal. He believed that individual autonomy of food and resources created an egalitarian society where everyone was about the same social status. He believed that such a society fosters the individual's virtues of democratic citizen and resulted in a working democracy. These civic virtues included an appreciation for hard work and a sense of pride in a job well done, an intimate knowledge of nature and her processes, a sense of proportion, self-reliance, and a love of family, and a community-based spirit. The bedrock of the Republic reside in its agrarian population. I now offer you some food for thought with a reading from Thomas Jefferson's answer to Query 29, Manufacturing, in the Notes on the State of Virginia. The question, the present state of manufacturers, commerce, interior, and exterior trade. Thomas Jefferson answers, we never had an interior trade of any importance. Our exterior commerce has suffered very much from the beginning of the present contest. During this time, we have manufactured within our families the most necessary articles of clothing. Those of cotton will bear some comparison with the same kinds of manufacture in Europe, but those of wool, flax, and hemp are very coarse, unsightly, and unpleasant, and such is our attachment to agriculture. In such our preference for foreign manufacturers, that be it wise or unwise, our people will certainly return as soon as they can to raising raw materials and exchange them for finer manufacturers than they are able to execute themselves. The political economists of Europe have established it as a principle that every state should endeavor to manufacture for itself. And this principle, like many others, we transfer to America without calculating the difference of circumstance, which should often produce a difference of result. In Europe, the lands are either cultivated or locked up against the cultivator. Manufacture must therefore be resorted to of necessity, not of choice, to support the surplus of their people. But we have an immensity of land, courting the industry of the husbandman. It is best, then, that all of our citizens should be employed in this improvement, or that one half should be called from that to exercise manufactures and handicraft arts for the other? Those who labor in the earth are the chosen people of God. If ever he had chosen people, whose breasts he made his peculiar deposit for substantial and genuine virtue. It is the focus in which he keeps alive that sacred fire, which otherwise might escape from the face of the earth. Corruption of morals in the mass of cultivators is a phenomenon of which no age or nation has furnished an example. It is the mark set on those who, not looking up to heaven, to their own soil and industry, as does the husbandman, for their subsistence, depend for it on the casualties and caprice of customers. Dependence begets subservience and veniality, suffocates the germ of virtue, and prepares it fit tools for the designs of ambition. This natural progress and consequence of the arts has sometimes perhaps been retarded by accidental circumstances. But generally speaking, the proportion which the aggregate of the other classes of citizens bears in any state to that of its husbandmen is the proportion of its unsound to its healthy parts, and it is a good enough barometer whereby to measure its degree of corruption. While we have land to labor, then, let us never wish to see our citizens occupied at a workbench or twirling a distaff. Carpenters, masons, smiths are wanting in husbandry, but for the general operations of manufacture, let our workshops remain in Europe. It is better to carry provisions and materials to workmen there than bring them to the provisions and materials, and with them their manners and principles. The loss by the transportation of commodities across the Atlantic will be made up in happiness and permanence of government. The mobs of great cities add just so much to the support of pure government as sores do to the strength of the human body. It is the manners and spirit of a people which preserve a republic in vigor. The degeneracy in these is a canker which soon eats to the heart of its laws and constitution.
Well, food is clearly controlling me right now because I've hit that time in the afternoon where I need a little something to get through the rest of the day.
Oh, and I found you at the snack machine.
Peanut M&M.
Good choice.
But I actually was standing here thinking, like, why am I doing this? Because I'm going to end up eating all these chemicals and stuff, and why am I doing that? But you'll see that I chose food anyway. So maybe it does control me. I'm not sure I'm answering your question. Like,
that was pretty good. I feel like I caught you doing
something. You caught me red-handed. I
and
definitely
you
feel
you felt like you had to explain that. But
yes. But I literally was thinking that as
really?
I was pushing the buttons. I'm like, oh, I should just go to the cafe and get a cookie because at least it's like, you know, flour and sugar and it's not things that I can't pronounce.
Thank you so much.
Well, when I go to the store to buy and make my own food, I always make sure that I buy organic because I'm really concerned about genetically modified organisms, and I try to avoid them when I make my own food. But I know if I eat out, then I have no control over that, and I just kind of assume it's there. But I think it might have health effects, so I really would want to know.
This is Emily Lane from Food Talk Radio bringing you the news this February. Unfortunately, Emily Lyons isn't here with me, so bear with me. There's a lot to cover. Most notably, the Farm Bill. So it has passed the United States House of Representatives. Some of the differences between the Farm Bill as it stands today and past Farm Bills is that it includes caps on farm subsidies. It ends direct payments, which paid farmers whether or not they grew crops. It also increases the funding for crop insurance and cuts food stamps by $8 billion, which is actually quite a compromise from the much larger number that the Republicans wanted to cut food stamps by. It's unclear whether President Obama will sign the bill into law because he has come out saying that he does not want to sign any farm bill that increases the funding of crop insurance or cut food stamps, but we'll see what happens. On Monday, February 3rd, the Senate will hear the reading of the bill. So, back to the normal format. Here's what's happening internationally, nationally, and locally here in Vermont. So, in the international news, I've got two fishy stories for you. China has banned American shellfish over high levels of arsenic. The certain shellfish involved are geoduck, oysters, and other double-shell aquatic animals. They're contaminated to the point that human consumption is unsafe. Fish are also testing at unsafe levels, 124 times over the radiation limit, actually, caught off the coast of Fukushima, and scientists are continuing to assess the damage caused by the nuclear disaster in 2011 to the marine food chain. In Argentina, Monsanto's seed plant was halted by a labor appeals court that ruled the construction of the plant is unconstitutional and halted work on the site. Russian scientists are urging a moratorium for genetically modified organisms to thoroughly study the influence on human health. And in Mali, there are warnings of serious food crisis. More than 800,000 people are in immediate need of food assistance, and 3 million people nationwide are at risk. Also, Germans, they came out whole hog to safeguard their pork production, to do sustainable agriculture and fight for their indigenous rights. They are upset about the transatlantic trade agreements. They object to the German government's support of industrial farming and see the trade agreement as creating largest single market in national news, of course, besides the farm bill. Recently, the United States Supreme Court has upheld Monsanto's claim on genetically engineered seed patents, and the court affirmed their ability to sue farmers whose fields are inadvertently contaminated with Monsanto's materials. The appeals court decision was based on Monsanto's supposed promise not to sue farmers whose crops, including soy, corn, cotton, canola, and others, that had traces of the company's biotechnology, that they wouldn't sue them. Monsanto has to date filed over 140 lawsuits against farmers for planting the company's genetically engineered seeds without permission, while they've already settled at least 700 other cases without going all the way to court. So what this means is that farmers have very little protection against genetic drift, and even though Monsanto has made a promise not to sue these farmers, the Supreme Court says that they still can if they want. So it's a confusing case. More on that later. The FDA did not act after deeming animal feed antibiotics high risk to humans. Based on the United States Food and Drug Administration's own safety analysis, 30 antibiotic feed additives formally approved for non-therapeutic use would not meet current agency health standards if submitted for approval today. In Virginia, anonymous users are no longer allowed to leave critical reviews on Yelp. This popular review site must now reveal the identities of 7 anonymous users who had left critical reviews for local businesses. Also of interest, McDonald's told its employees to avoid burgers and fries because it's risky for your health. Expressing concerns over their employees' health has backfired, and the leading fast food producer, McDonald's, has taken down its site following ridicule for telling its workers to avoid their own product. Consumer Reports has a new study that a disturbingly high percentage of raw chicken breasts sold in the United States contain potentially harmful bacteria,
One more sad story. California is having a severe drought with no sign of rain. About 40,000 people are in danger of running out of water in the next 60 to 120 days. State officials said that the number is likely to rise in the months ahead. The State Water Project, which is the main municipal water distribution system, announced that they are turning off the taps. And this is the first time that they've closed the spigot in their 54-year history. And in happier news, 38 states now have legislation that supports farm-to-school. According to a new report from the National Farm to School Network and the Center for Agriculture and Food Systems. In local news, there are free classes on wellness being offered by the Fletcher Allen Hospital at UVM over the coming months, if anyone's interested. New Hampshire has voted down the GMO labeling bill and the GMO labeling bill in Vermont. In the coming weeks, they will hear testimony from the public and then shortly vote on this bill, which is currently called H-112. Here's Emily Lyons with some information on the right to farm.
A bunch of states have passed or proposed new or amendments to the right to farm. Can you explain what's the significance of that?
Yes. So right to farm laws are basically laws passed by states to protect agricultural operations of all sizes from nuisance lawsuits from their neighbors. Ohio, Indiana, and Missouri have recently passed or proposed these right to farm laws that allow for greater protection of farmers and promote agriculture within their states. This really allows farmers to be able to stay in their location and continue their operations, which helps states sustain their agricultural programs, as well as potentially allows individuals to know where their food comes from because it's from their community.
The only control we have is how much energy we want to put into locating and returning, you know, getting our food. And by energy, how much money or time or effort we want to put into the selection of our food. And different people put different time and energy, but that you can choose. You can be lazy, you know, not go very far, you can work harder. But at a certain point, you don't have a choice. You have to eat, so
yeah,
it's a closed loop, and that's tied to, you know, class. It's tied to birth. It's tied to location. It's tied to accident of, you know.
Well, food will sometimes control me by the taste and the flavor and the texture. And how do I control my food? By the scales. I do not eat something if I think I'm going to gain a fair amount of weight from it. So I watch my scales. That's how I control my food. But flavor is a big one for me.
Okay.
As I say, for the way I control food, it's also about where you buy it. So, you know, you try to buy local as much as you can. You try to control what you put into your body. So all of us want to eat healthier, so that kind of ties into the organic piece where it's nice to know where your food comes from. But, yeah, food controls me the same way. If it tastes good, I'm right there. I'm like, I can eat that. It's like, it's calling my name. If it looks good, and it's, God forbid you're at a fair, it's all over. It's like all the food in the fair controls me that day until I leave, but yeah. Oh, it's great stuff, but yeah. So that's the way it runs my life.
I've worked for Maple Hill for a long time, probably for 5 or 6 years. I started there as an AmeriCorps, a national service member, and from the beginning I was doing a variety of things. I was essentially co-managing the working farm at the school, and I essentially was managing the animal portion. So we worked to install a management intensive rotational grazing system, which is basically a system of grazing which aims to mimic natural herd rotation, and in that way have a regenerative effect in the landscape through sequestering carbon, through building topsoil, through creating animals who have really healthy meat and fatty acid ratios because they're eating the stuff they're supposed to be eating, which is grass and legumes, etc., but not grain. Essentially, my agreement with Maple Hill was that I would raise a number of animals which I felt was appropriate for the land base, that the land base could sustain. So we raised 5 cattle there, I got them all as yearlings, or essentially they were a year old to a little less than 2 years old when I got them. I got them from two different sources, and had them transported to the farm. And my deal with Maple Hill was that I would raise these five animals. They would get two of the animals in the long run, which means that I would send those animals to a USDA-inspected slaughter facility. I would arrange for that.
This is for the school.
This is for the school, to feed the student.
Not that any payment was taking place, but this was sort of the trade-off for you being able to use the property.
Yep. So it's more or less, you know, an informal lease agreement. But it was more of an exchange where my labor, I was there to maintain the fencing, to maintain the pastures, to graze these animals, and in exchange, I could graze a few of my own. My animals move in through day paddocks in a field. They're not used to coming through the barn. I move them essentially through the barn as a way to isolate the ones I want to put in the truck. So I trap them in the barn. They already realize that something's amiss, something's different. The truck backs up. There's the beeping noises. There's all this, you know. And depending on how, on your relationship with your animals, your relationship with the person who's helping you deliver the animals and truck them, you know, the situation can be more or less stressful for yourself and for the animals. You know, there's certainly no horror stories about getting animals on a trailer, but at the same time, as someone who's done it, I hate doing it. I hate sending, I just feel this deep sense of betrayal. There's these animals that I have literally every day been visiting and been caretaking, and, it just feels really awful putting them onto a trailer and sending them to New Hampshire to a facility where I don't know the people who's gonna kill them. They don't know that environment. And so there's that whole emotional part, which is really important, as well as the potential for the quality of the meat to be affected by stress. So that's sort of what I did this year. And so the animals which I was raising, I decided that I wanted to do it on farm. I knew that from the beginning. I wanted to be involved in that process. And I'd heard about the on-farm slaughter exemption. I hadn't, as I said, read through the law. But I had an impression that I was allowed to do something like 4 to 6 live shares of an animal. So basically what I told people who I knew were interested in having beef for the winter, and who had approached about this, I told them that you have to buy your animal while it's alive from me. So I'll need a deposit from you, which basically is you assuring that you have ownership over this animal or part of this animal. And I will, you know, you're welcome to always come to the farm. I'll keep you updated throughout the season on sort of how things are going. I will recommend a slaughterer to you, and I will recommend a place where we might want to take these animals to get butchered and processed. And, you know, as the season went along, things were going well. I was in touch with folks. And when it came time to get close to slaughter, I said, this is a slaughter who I've been recommended.
The Durkees.
And I said, what do you guys think? A number of people responded, yeah, well, you know, we trust what you think on this. You're much more involved in that scene than we are. So I made the call to the Durkees. I asked them if they would visit the farm on a particular day to slaughter all three animals. Then I'd also already made contacts with the Mad River Valley Food Hub, which is run by a friend of mine named Jacob Vinson, who is the butcher there and does some other work there. And one of my goals was to really allow this to be a really participatory process. So I asked Jacob if he taught classes. Essentially, would he be willing to take people who bought that meat and teach them to cut off those carcasses? And he was, which is one of the reasons I wanted to choose him. I originally had a few people who were interested in that, and in the long run, I was really the only person who got to engage with that because of how it turned out with the beef being retained and everything. So everyone okayed Jacob as the person to go to, and essentially they had to have the relationship with him. I knew that at that point, the animal was probably considered meat. It was no longer alive. So my relationship with Jacob was around my carcass, and everybody else had their own personal relationship with Jacob around cut sheets. So I guess I would quickly say that, you know, this one of the pieces that is illegal in there is that I arranged for the slaughter. Now, as the clients rightfully said, you know, I'm much more in the scene than them in terms of on-farm slaughter, farming, etc. And they definitely appreciated me suggesting somebody and trusted that. It was relevant for me to actually call them and say, and suggest when to come and to be there for a number of reasons. One, because it wasn't just one cow being slaughtered owned by one person, it was three cattle being slaughtered. So may as well just have one person make the call. Two, it's at a school. I think this is, you know, this question of sanitation seems to be at the heart of this to the Agency of Ag and to the USDA. What constitutes safe practices and to whom? And, you know, my experience with on-farm slaughter has always been, especially with larger animals, it's been very clean. I've always been very impressed with the slaughterers and also the butchers, because, you know, a butcher is not going to, they don't want to take meat that could potentially be contaminated. They're going to recommend to the farmer, if asked, you know, the best slaughterer they know. They're going to, and it's the farmer's responsibility and the butcher's responsibility and the slaughterer's responsibility to make sure that basically their reputation's depending on it, their livelihood depends on it, on making sure that everything goes well. And we helped Jacob to carry it in, and we hang it in a humidity and temperature control facility where it will hang for 10 to 18 days. And the Mad River Valley Food Hub is an inspected facility, so a random inspector came through, saw the carcasses hanging, asked for paperwork, saw that those carcasses were from an on-farm slaughter, and saw that there were multiple owners per carcass. And upon seeing that, slapped a retainer on them, which means that you cannot, this meat needs to stay where it is for now.
This is someone with the Vermont Agency of Agriculture.
This is someone with the Vermont Agency of Agriculture, not the USDA. Which I feel very grateful that it was not the USDA. And I know, you know, in the agency's eyes, they've been very lenient. They feel like they've been very lenient in this case. They feel like they've given me what they feel is a reasonable fine. They feel like they could have destroyed the meat, and they didn't. But from my perspective, it all feels like I've had my livelihood threatened. I've had the food security of myself, my friends, and family threatened. And I don't feel like I've done anything wrong. And I also feel like just the relationship with the agency has not been a positive experience. I felt like I was threatened a number of times. And there was really poor communication, especially at the front end. I mean, I'm not sure if you can imagine what it's like to have essentially these three carcasses hanging in a facility, and all of a sudden to hear, not from the agency, but from the butcher, that the meat has been retained and that he can't touch it. But you don't, again, I didn't hear from the agency, I heard from the butcher. So all the questions I would have as to what the hell is going on, there was no way to get a response from that. And then I immediately started trying to email and contact Randy Kenneville and Mike Mitchell, who I knew were inspectors, just to say, hey, I didn't think I was doing anything wrong. What's happening? You know, what's the next step? And it's a pretty intimidating situation to have, you know, it's something to take a large animal's life and to have that kind of relationship with an animal. And then to know that I'm all of a sudden out of control of the situation, and that meat and that whole relationship I had could just go to naught for no good reason. Yeah.
Got no way. Now shapes like